abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And welcome, everybody, on this October 14th, 2013. Talking Austrian economics today. You all know Austrian economics. Ron Paul made it cool. A lot of people were laboring in that particular vineyard for many, many years, but now it's sort of chic to belong to the Austrian school of economic thought. Of course, the Austrian school has nothing to do with Austria, per se. Some of the early thinkers came from Austria, but today there are more people working in the Austrian tradition of economic thought in the United States than in all of Austria, that's for sure. But I'm going to be talking today in this program. I've got a segment for you from a television program I did when I was in West Virginia giving a lecture. They snagged me for a program called On Money, and I thought you might like to hear it. It's an opportunity for me to be able to speak and talk about the Austrian school with an interviewer who is sympathetic or at the very least lets me speak. So I thought I'd share that with you because, of course, once Ron Paul really got the ball rolling, really popularized Austrian economics, now we've got a whole generation of young students who are fascinated by this, who really want to learn this stuff. So I hope this program today is a bit of a gateway for you guys. And if you're interested in this stuff, you want to learn more about it, I put up some resources, ways you can learn Austrian economics. Be cool like other people, like Peter Schiff and all those people. And that's at my resource page, learnaustrianeconomics.com. And don't forget, immediately before this program airs for the first time in the noon Eastern stream at tomwoodsradio.com, you can be listening to Peter Schiff for 2 solid hours at schiffradio.com. So all kinds of opportunities to learn this stuff. I just got back from a weekend in Las Vegas. One of these first world problems. I had to spend the weekend in Las Vegas. I had a speaking engagement on Friday night. It was mostly a new audience for me, so that's always exciting. And people seemed to like my message, so that was a lot of fun. And I brought my wife, and we spent the weekend in Vegas. So very glad to be able to do that, but also glad to be back here talking to you guys. And coming up this weekend, October 19th, Saturday, I'm going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina. I have had so many people say to me, you've got to come to North Carolina. Okay, so I'm doing it. So now you've got to be there, right? Or that's it. I'm just never coming back. After all this griping about not coming to North Carolina, I'm doing it already. So check out nullifynow.com for details on that event. Mike Church of Sirius XM Satellite Radio will be there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Raleigh, North Carolina, this Saturday. Be there or be square. November 11th, don't forget, Miami University in Ohio. I'm going to be putting up the logistical details on that within the next couple of days. If I haven't done so by the time I put this up, I'll get to it. But November 11th, save the date. It'll be from 7 to 8 p.m. in some big auditorium, so you got to show up to fill those seats. You get in for free, and it'll be great. You get to meet a lot of like-minded people. You'll have a great time. And then November 20th, if you're in the St. Louis area, I'm going to be at St. Louis University Law School at lunchtime talking about secession. Can you believe that? A law student association invited me to come talk about the constitutionality of secession. And then I'll be speaking at Lindenwood University in St. Charles, Missouri in the afternoon. But the big thing is October 19th, Raleigh, North Carolina. It's on nullification. If you can't make it, you can console yourself by reading a free chapter of my book, Nullification, by going to nullificationfreechapter.com. But today, as I say, I'm going to share with you a bit from a TV program I did called On Money. This was in Wheeling, West Virginia, not too terribly long ago. And I hope you enjoy it. Here it is.
Hi, I'm Pete Holloway. I'm a certified financial planner and a senior vice president with Haislett, Burton & Watson here in Wheeling. And as always, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to On Money. Today we have a very special edition of On Money. I'm especially pleased to have as my guest Dr. Thomas Woods, one of the best-known economists and historians in the country. Today we're going to be exploring today's financial crisis, among other topics, from the standpoint of economic theory. Don't get worried. We're going to be speaking in English. And by the end of this show, you should have a solid understanding of the thinking that's going on behind the debates in Washington right now, and maybe explain to you how some of these issues should be resolved. Dr. Woods is a native of Andover, Massachusetts. He received his undergraduate degree in history from Harvard and has a PhD in history from Columbia. Currently, he's the senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He's written 11 books to date. Two of them, Meltdown and The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, have been New York Times bestsellers. Along with Channel 14, he's been on NBC, CNBC, Fox News, Fox Business, Bloomberg, and so forth. He's married with four children, ranging in ages from 1.5 to 8. And I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Pete. Thank you.
Now we're going to start saying some of those words. Don't worry, the audience, please. We're going to explain what all these things mean. Now, you're a fan of the Austrian School of Economics. This is an educational institution, and we're going to have an educational talk today. Can you compare and contrast that line of thought, the Austrian economics, with the Keynesian school, and how would you use the Austrian School of Economics to help resolve today's economic crisis?
Right. Now, Pete, you're right. People will think, I have no idea what this is. This is some kind of gobbledygook, but people have got to know this stuff.
They really do.
I mean, you know, people, I think, have been led to believe sometimes that economics is boring or these topics are boring, but you know, I think the fact that I'm being looted and expropriated is quite interesting, as a matter of fact, and so I would like to know more about it. Well, particularly, just starting off with, what do we mean by Austrian School of Economics? It has nothing to do with Austria, per se. It's not a physical school. It's a school of thought. It's mm-hmm. a way of thinking about the economy. And the Austrian School, which is the oldest continuously existing school of economic thought in the world, has been in eclipse for many years. It hasn't been in the mainstream of economics. People have neglected it. One of its economists won the Nobel Prize in 1974, but really it's been on the outs with the profession. But then this financial crisis hit in 2008 in particular, and suddenly there's a rebirth of interest in the Austrian school, because so many Austrian economists had predicted that this would happen. They predicted the contours of it to a T, and people began to wonder, how did these people know? What kind of intellectual apparatus did they have that allowed them to see something that so many economists, thousands and thousands, totally missed? So we contrast the Austrians, first of all, though, with the so-called the Keynesians. They mm-hmm. follow an economist named John Maynard Keynes. Now, Keynes is probably the most significant economist of the past 200 years. I don't mean he's the best, but I mean he's the most influential. He has had so much influence on the way governments have carried out economic policy. And so anytime you hear something like, we need fiscal stimulus to jumpstart the economy.
Now, fiscal stimulus.
That means, like, for example, with the Obama stimulus, there are other examples of stimulus.
QE2.
When we spend, yeah, that's monetary
push a
stimulus.
Lot of money in.
Fiscal stimulus would be when the government just spends mm-hmm. much more money than yeah. it had been previously spending. So a lot of times it'll borrow a lot of money so that it can spend a lot. And the idea is that the additional spending, the Keynesians tend to think of the economy as just a lot of spending. So spending slows down, we get to rev spending back up again. Now, of course, you can't do justice to these schools, you know, just a short answer. But when you hear this kind of analysis, that the economy sort of on its own tends toward unemployment or underemployment of resources, and we need managers, you know, to manage the economy with stimulus, or for example, the Keynesian model used to be that if inflation, that is, if prices are going up, then we want to pull money and spending out of the economy to tamp that down. If unemployment is going up, we want to pour money and spending into the economy to bring that down. But what began to happen in the early 70s was we had both simultaneously. We had inflation up and unemployment up. So what was the Keynesian going to do? Was he going to pump money in and take it out at the same time? So pretty intellectually, they were finished in the 70s. But there has been a huge revival in this way of thinking in the past few years. And the great rival of the Keynesians is the Austrian school. And the Austrian answer to the Keynesians is that these boom and bust cycles that we have to endure, where we're doing great and then everybody's in the toilet and then we're doing great, this is not a natural feature of the market economy. This is caused by various interventions into the economy. And so further interventions are not going to cure what the initial ones caused. What the economy needs instead is breathing room to liquidate bad investments, to start again afresh, to build on sound foundations again for the future, not just a whole lot of arbitrary government spending. And I'll just note, finally, that after during World War II, there were a lot of Keynesian economists in the U.S. who predicted that when the government inevitably cut back spending when the war ended, because obviously when the people are going to be demobilized, they're going to be spending less money on the army and so forth, that this would lead to a terrible depression because spending would be reduced. And the Austrians said, no, this won't lead to a depression at all. The price system and wages will adjust and we'll integrate everybody into a civilian economy and it'll be fine. The market will adjust to this. It'll be fine. But we were hearing predictions of, 10 million unemployed would come out of this, be the worst depression ever. Well, what actually happened? Here we have finally a test of Keynesian theories. Did this drop off in government spending lead to a terrible catastrophe? To the contrary, 1946 was the single most productive year for the private economy in all of U.S. history. So it seems to me like on the battlefield, so to speak, of ideas, the Keynesians are just out of ammunition, and yet they're in the New York Times, they're in all the financial networks, but the Austrians are cracking through because of YouTube and the internet allowing us to get around these gatekeepers of approved opinion, and because the Austrians have a track record that the Keynesians can only dream of.
Now, you've been talking about one person, John Maynard Keynes. Can you give us one or two names of the Austrians and what their philosophies were?
The winner of the Nobel Prize in 1974 was F.A. Hayek. Mm-hmm. Who's a very significant thinker, and he won the prize for work he had done decades earlier on explaining why we have a boom-bust cycle in the first place. Why does the economy move in cycles like this? And he was not inclined to blame this on the free market. He blamed it on central bank intervention and that gets the economy on sort of a sugar high that it crashes from. And his contemporary Ludwig von Mises, after which the institute I am associated with, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, is named, was perhaps the greatest. I mean, I would say Ludwig von Mises, F.A. Hayek, and Murray Rothbard are probably the three most accomplished Austrian economists. And Mises had, what a life this guy led. I mean, he lives in Austria for some time. He's in the Chamber of Commerce. He gets a position teaching in Switzerland. And then as the 1930s wear on, he realizes, okay, I'm a Jewish man teaching free market economics in increasingly Nazi-dominated Europe. This is not looking good. Because obviously Hitler, although you hear people on the left who can't make distinctions, they think Hitler supported capitalism. Well, Mises is talking about real, genuine, private property capitalism, the international division of labor. Hitler's talking about imperialism and autarky. This is the opposite. So Mises finally thought, this is not a hospitable place for me. And in fact, his library was confiscated, his papers were taken. We only found them decades later, scattered around the world. Mises and his wife fled through, they went through France to Spain and then Portugal to get to the U.S. in 1940, almost empty-handed at age 59. And you would think, well, this guy's career is over. That's it for him. And yet he stuck to it. He had books, three books that decade published by Yale University Press, including his great treatise, Human Action. And by the time he died in 1973, he was still relatively unknown, and his ideas were neglected. And yet when he wrote his notes and recollections, he did not rebuke himself for being too uncompromising, or maybe if I had said what the authorities wanted me to say and said the free market is good up to a point but not so good after that point, maybe I would have been more accepted. He rebuked himself for being too soft. And the year after he died, his student, well, his colleague anyway, Hayek, wins the Nobel Prize. And now today, we've got a generation of young people who are fascinated by the Austrian school. We've got 2 million-plus viewed YouTube videos, rap videos, Hayek versus Keynes. This has never been seen before. So Mises couldn't have known this. But this is a great example of a life well-lived. He stands up telling the Nazis the opposite of what they want to hear. He tells the Social Democrats in the U.S. the opposite of what they want to hear. His work suffers in relative obscurity. He dies having done his best, and today there's this fantastic revival of his ideas that, and Mises, M-I-S-E-S, that he could never have dreamed of.
And there is a website. Maybe you could give the
Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. If you don't ever want to go out of your house ever again, you could spend the rest of your life exploring the resources on Mises.org. I don't recommend that, but it could be done.
Now, let's get to reality. How would the Austrian School of Economics handle today's crisis? What kinds of things would they do now? And what might they have done in, say, 2008?
Well, the first thing they want to do is figure out what the causes were. And this may seem obvious, but I recall Paul Krugman, who's sort of the house Keynesian at the New York Times, and a Nobel Prize winner. So unfortunately, Hayek's prize has now been watered down. But I remember Krugman actually saying, you know, a lot of people are talking about what the causes were, and, you know, to heck with that. Let's deal with what to do about it. But the Austrian position would be you can't know what to do about it unless you know what the causes are. Mm-hmm. So the Austrians begin with that. They don't begin by asking, why did we have this terrible bust, you know, where housing prices fell and foreclosures were up and people's stock portfolios were decimated. The question they first ask is, why did we have a boom to start with? Was this a really sound boom? Was the prosperity real and enduring and built on a sound foundation? Or was it phony? And the Austrian argument, to put it in an extreme nutshell, basically is this, that the economy more or less does adjust to shocks and things of that nature on its own, but that one thing that's difficult for it to adjust to is when it's attacked, in effect, from within by the central bank, by the Federal Reserve System. And the argument is that when the Fed intervenes, and a lot of people don't even know what the Federal Reserve System is. This is the, but you got to. You've got to understand this. This is the central bank in the U.S., and it has the monopoly power to create legal tender money. And it uses this power, we're told, to fine-tune the economy, to make sure that it doesn't overheat or that it doesn't slow down too much. It's supposed to maximize output, maximize employment, minimize price inflation, and all these things. Now, I argue that its record on this has not been so hot. That's a separate issue. But the point is that Alan Greenspan, in the year 2001, when we were just recovering very slowly from the dot-com bust, in 2001, he uses the Fed's power to push interest rates down. He lowers interest rates 11 times in that 1 year alone. And that seems great, right? We think, well, low interest rate, who could be against that? The problem is that the low interest rates have consequences for the economy. They lead investors to make decisions they wouldn't have made otherwise. There are particular kinds of investment outlets that are sensitive to interest rate changes that now investors are more likely to invest in. But the economy would normally be saying to investors, don't invest in this. But when you interfere with these signals to entrepreneurs, it creates a lot of white noise when they make their decisions, and it causes them to channel money into unsustainable paths. And in particular, consumers were misled into getting way too involved in housing. The 1999-2001 recession is the only one on record where housing starts and housing prices actually went up. Normally, housing has a slump during a recession. They went up. And this is because, well, instead of allowing the economy to correct, maybe we'd been too invested in housing, you keep pushing those interest rates down. Instead of letting interest rates serve as a brake, say, no, stop, you're doing too much. You shouldn't be quitting your job, buying 5 investment properties on an interest-only loan, and just sitting there waiting to get rich. There's something wrong about that. That's not sane. Interest rates were not able to send that signal. So instead of red lights, everything was green.
Yeah, you make the point, interest is the cost of money. And you made the point that if in some of your writings, that if that it should have self-corrected, if there was demand because people wanted to buy the houses, interest rates should have naturally
should have gone up. And then speculation in real estate would have died down. People would have said, well, it's not such a great investment to go into real estate because it's too expensive to borrow. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the bottom line of it is the Austrians would say there was a lot of intervention in the economy, both from the government proper and from the central bank, making particular types of investments seem artificially attractive. And so when Greenspan did this, instead of letting us have that moderate recession and allowing everything to be cleared out, we start all over again without all these entrepreneurial errors, he locks the errors in. He encourages people to persist, to carry on in what they've been doing, so that when the crash came, it was all the worse. So now that we have a kind of grasp on, you know, who were the actors that really made this crisis so severe, then that helps figure out what should be done. When the first answer, Austrian answer, would be the opposite of a lot of the mainstream answers. Their answer would be pump more money in and force lower interest rates. And the Austrian answer is, but if the lower interest rates cause the problem, how could they be the solution? We want to stop doing that because these things are diverting resources into the wrong channels. We don't want additional government stimulus in the form of more borrowing and spending, because that siphons resources from the private sector and allocates them toward economically arbitrary projects. The private sector is starved for capital. You can't keep doing that to the private sector. Basically, what we want to do is see the opposite done, is have as much turned back over into the hands of the private sector as possible, so that private entrepreneurs using the price system can help us recover. Because sometimes people say, you Austrians think we shouldn't do anything. But it depends on who's we. They shouldn't do anything, the politicians, but we have a lot of work to do. Entrepreneurs have to figure out which sectors of the economy are bubble sectors that need to be reduced, and which are sectors that have been starved for resources and need to be expanded. And there's no non-arbitrary way for a politician to know that. Only an entrepreneur risking his own capital, responding to prices, can know what needs to be done. That's what needs to occur right now.
Okay. Now, let's go back historically again to the Great Depression of 1920. Now, so Pete, you mean 1930, don't you? There was a depression in 1920. Why haven't we heard about it? And what happened that we didn't? I mean, there was a depression. How come it wasn't a big issue like the depression of the 30s?
Well, this is one of these interesting lost episodes from history that's now being recovered. Mm-hmm. The so-called depression of 1920 to 21. This is an episode, you're right, nobody's ever heard of this. They all think of the Great Depression mm-hmm. of 29 and 30. What's going on here? Well, in 1920, we had double-digit unemployment. We had industrial production figures way down. I mean, just every statistic you can imagine was just heading downward. And what's interesting about it is the government response, because it was Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was largely incapacitated because of series of strokes mm-hmm. by 1920. And then his successor, Warren Harding, well, I think he's been hit too hard by historians, but nobody has ever accused him of being the greatest genius in the history of the world. By the time it occurred to Harding that maybe he might try to do something, the thing was all over already anyway. So it's interesting to know what actually was done. Well, over several years' time, the government budget was actually cut pretty much in half. We saw the Federal Reserve played an extremely minimal role, as historians have all conceded in this. They didn't do anything to really pump up the money supply. If you can look at the money supply figures until 1922, but the National Bureau of Economic Research says the recovery was already occurring by late 1921. So in other words, and I think now this gets to your question, why don't we know about this? Here we have a severe downturn that is corrected with basically no government intervention at all in roughly a year. And then within 2 years, they're setting production records once again. You know, everybody's doing great. Well, when the government wants us to learn the lessons of history always turn out to be that we would be a bunch of pathetic, stupid rubes without the government managing the economy. But that's not the lesson you draw from this episode, so we just don't talk about this episode.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're getting towards the end of the show. I gave you a little plug. You've got a new book coming out. Can you tell us about the book? And
yeah, the book is out called Rollback, mm-hmm. and the subtitle is Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. And I'll give you the 10%, 90% version. The 10% of the book is, here's the impossible fiscal crisis we're facing, with the entitlement programs being underfunded by an amount twice the GDP of the whole world. That's got to be faced. But the 90% of the book is not about the budget. The 90% of the book is just saying this, that given that we have to cut back, it's unavoidable, absolutely unavoidable. The funds will not be there. It's time to revisit a lot of the programs that we've been sold over the years as being indispensable and we'd all be dead without them. And when we actually reevaluate them, I actually find that not only would we survive without a lot of this spending, we would flourish. So the fiscal crisis is an opportunity to be embraced, not a calamity to be deplored.
Can you be more specific about some of the things that you would suggest?
Well, when I go into even the tiniest programs, from tiny ones to big ones, but certainly the military sector, a lot of conservatives think you can't cut that because then, you know, the Muslims will take over. But that has been so badly mismanaged over the past 10 years. There's no audit of the Department of Defense. Huge amounts of money we can't even account for. You've got to start there. And then smaller things. I mean, in terms of when you look at the welfare state or the cabinet departments, these have not produced what we were told they would produce. The welfare state has had the opposite of the intended effect, and they just keep throwing money at it without any discernible effect. Well, you have to. That can't go on. That's got to stop.
Now, you're specifically talking cutting programs. The big debate in Washington right now is cut programs, raise taxes, a combination.
Right.
Why haven't you mentioned raising taxes?
Well, because we all know what's going to happen. They're just going to blow the money on other things. So, I mean, if you keep doing that, it's like raising the debt ceiling. If you keep doing it, when does it ever stop? When do they say, but this is all we need? We don't need any more of your tax money. I mean, are they ever going to say that? So you've got to just cut it now.
Do you feel that 2010 elections delivered a message, or...?
A bit. It'd be nice if the Republicans and if the general public were more informed about the severity of the crisis. Maybe they'd be more open to the frankly rather austere approach that needs to be taken to fight against it. $38 billion cut from this budget is like 10 cents off a trip to the moon. Unfortunately,
that's it. One last bit. We've drifted over into politics and so forth. The Mises Institute is a libertarian. Can you give us a quick definition of libertarian? All too often we think red state, blue state, and simplify things way too much. Tell us about the libertarian philosophy that you espouse.
Yeah, just very quickly, the libertarian philosophy is based on one principle, the so-called non-aggression principle, that nobody should initiate aggressive force against an innocent person. Now, you can use defensive force if somebody comes and attacks you. That would be justified. But we base our ideas about government and society on the idea that nobody should initiate violence, that only a thug initiates violence, that you achieve your ends through reason and persuasion.
Okay. And in terms of economics, how would you continue that line of thought?
Well, it means that, economically speaking, this is why libertarians are sometimes thought of as conservatives. Economically speaking, it means, well, if you work and you acquire wealth, that belongs to you, and nobody has the right to come over and forcibly confiscate that from you on the grounds that they've got some social plan that they need to satisfy with your wealth. And it turns out that this is not just some terrible, greedy philosophy. It turns out that, in fact, the private sector, the voluntary sector, is much more effective and much more generous when it comes to dealing with things like providing for the arts, providing for the sciences, providing for the poor. I mean, just providing for the sciences, on a per capita basis, the private sector was much more generous with the sciences than the government has ever been, but that was before estate taxes decimated everybody's fortunes. So it goes to show that our society can have less aggression, less injustice, more prosperity, and more shared prosperity if we just put the guns down and stopped having everybody trying to loot everybody else through the mechanism of government.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much. As always, these shows go too quickly. I wish I had an extra half hour with you because I'd like to, and I'm sure the viewers too, would like to pick your brain some more. I want to say that Dr. Woods, today is Friday, June 30th. He's going to be giving a talk at noon, and I believe it's going to be shown right after this program. If not, please watch for his other talk, which we delivered to the West Liberty Economics Club. I'm Pete Holloway. I want to thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
All right, that's it for the program for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, you can get the education that they should have given us, but we didn't get, but you can now get while driving in your car. That's at mylibertyclassroom.com. And don't forget, if you're in the market for a plasma TV and you're going to order it through Amazon, it doesn't have to be a plasma TV, it could be anything. You're going to order it through Amazon. Think to yourself, isn't there something I should be doing right now? Isn't there some good cause out there I should be contributing to? Make sure and place your Amazon order right at tomwoodsradio.com. Enter Amazon from there, and at no cost to you, you help us keep the lights on so I can have an office to do this quietly. I got 4 kids with a 5th on the way. Pretty hard to do a program in peace. So here I am in my own office. So thank you guys so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.